Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
New CBS Monday.
Federal agents.
Here's where we can see them.
NCIS Hawaii is back. About to set it up. New criminals to catch.
Armed robbery, aggravated assault, murder.
And new investigations to be solved.
These guys were good, but even masters make mistakes.
Vanessa Lachey and featuring LL Cool J.
Violent Island, you got it.
Welcome to paradise.
A new NCIS Hawaii, Monday, 10, 9 central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
What's up, y'all, and welcome back to the Barton and Bud podcast. A little weird to be doing this without Barton. We will have Barton on for a final episode of the podcast feed to discuss his new role with Vanderbilt. Obviously, huge congratulations to a good friend of mine and former colleague who's now going to be running the recruiting show at Vandy whenever that's official. We'll have Barton back on. But we do have a national championship to preview, maybe look back a little bit at what we saw in the semifinals. And I was thinking who I wanted to have on to do this, and a lot of good potential guests, but a guy who I really enjoy following, I think first started following him on Twitter is Deontay Lee, guy on Twitter at DLee underscore TPC, like the golf tournament, at DLee underscore TPC, also the Post Corner, cleveland.com, and the defensive coordinator at Mar Vista High School there in SoCal. So Deontay, man, welcome to Barton and Bud.
Thank you, man. I've been listening for a while. I'm definitely more than excited to join.
So this is a really fun national championship matchup. It doesn't necessarily feel, predetermined to me. And I think we learned a lot about at least one of these teams in the semifinal. The other one, maybe not quite as much. But one thing I put out this week, this is the most talented, by the blue chip ratio at least, national championship ever. I mean, you have Alabama with 83% of its roster recruited as blue chips, Ohio State with 80. That's absurd. That is just incredible. And when you watch these teams, it's hard to judge them sometimes because athletically they're just so much better than even the SEC and high quality Big Ten teams that they play. Like, there's just a difference that they've out-recruited the rest of the league for the most part. I mean, Georgia's got dudes, obviously, and Florida's got dudes on offense. This is, to me, this is a difficult matchup to break down at times just because of the athleticism that you don't see from opponents. Like, how do you figure out what's real?
Absolutely. And I've referenced the blue chip ratio in previewing this because it is kind of ridiculous now that I'm looking at teams in the 60s, high 50s, and I really feel like they would not have a shot. It will be a blowout if they were to face off against these two teams. So it does make it difficult trying to do like prep and find like quality of opponent that lines up. So I've had to go back and watch like Oklahoma in the semifinal when they played Alabama to see, okay, what does it look like when there are two receivers who are elite? How do they respond to that? Ohio State gets almost nothing like this from a competition standpoint in their conference play. So before the playoff, you really don't have a feel for exactly how teams will match up. I think that we kind of got hit in the face with that with Clemson a little bit. A lot of people had assumptions that because the ACC is a little bit weaker, we don't get a good look at where the atrophies are for Clemson's talent. And we kind of got to wake up for that. So national championship game, this is something to me that's been kind of unprecedented. We're seeing this spike in offensive production from teams. Like you said, the talent disparity between teams like this that are in this tier versus the rest of the nation, we really don't have much of a point of reference for matchups like these anymore.
So one thing that we always play on this show, and the show's only been around for a year, but I don't see any reason not to play it, is does the opponent have the receivers to match up with the Alabama game? Just to refresh the listeners, this is just a hard and fast rule that I've been tracking for about a decade now. Nick Saban is a defensive backs coach at heart. before he was a DC, he was DB coach, with Belichick there in Cleveland. He recruits absolute studs at corner. And if he can play your guys with, one-on-one matchups on the outside and you can't beat him, he's not going to come out of that. And he's going to bring pressure, get ball out of your quarterback's hands quickly. Again, just the rundown. Here are the Nick Saban losses at Alabama in the games that we're going to define them as basically trying. So I'm going to take out that Utah loss because I'm not really sure that they cared all that much about that game. Utah fans can send the hate mail to barton.simmons@cbsinteractive.com. So UF08, Harvin, Murphy, Hernandez, 2010 LSU, Reuben Randall, 2010 South Carolina, a little guy named Alshon Jeffrey, 2011 LSU, Reuben Randall, and a dude named Odell, even though they didn't throw that much that year. 2012, A&M had a guy named Evans, pretty good. 13, Auburn, Sammy Coates, Ricardo Lewis. They busted in the NFL, but they still got picked fairly high, second, fourth round. And they beat Alabama that year, despite the fact they had a corner playing quarterback, or a guy who was a corner at Georgia. Yeah. 14, Ole Miss, everybody knows, Ingram and Treadwell. 14, Ohio State, a team that I don't think at the time we knew how good those guys were going to be, but Thomas, Samuel, and Smith on that 14 Ohio State team. 15, Ole Miss again, Ingram, Treadwell, and Cody Core, tight end, who went in the sixth round. 16, Clemson, Kane, Leggett, Williams, Renfro, Auburn, 2017. The one that doesn't fit the most to me, just Slayton, but 2018, Clemson, Ross, Higgins, Renfro, and 2019 LSU, Chase Jefferson, Moss, Marshall, still ridiculous to say. And then obviously Williams, who I think will go pretty high in the draft, most likely from Auburn in 19. And what's his name? The track star from South Florida.
Shorts, Auburn. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Exactly. So with that said, I believe Ohio State passes this test. And generally, if they don't pass that test, we just kind of skip forward to the next game. But there is no game to skip forward to. So I'm really glad that they do pass this test because we actually have a matchup to talk about because Garrett Wilson is ridiculous. I mean, he was wearing out my battery at that 7-on-7 final at Adidas when he was just mossing everybody there. And Chris Olave is no slouch. The one thing, I guess we'll start here. They kind of sucker punched Clemson a little bit in that game. What we had speculated on the show, look, we know they have more talent than Clemson. We kind of compared them to that 2014 Ohio State team. They hadn't really played at that elite level yet, but they've got dudes. And so if they can get it together, there may be a gear they can get into that they haven't shown us yet. Deontay, they found that gear, but how, in your mind, how did they find that?
So I think it starts with the Northwestern game and the run game. Trey Sermon being 100%, I think really kind of opened things up for them. People have referenced this, throughout the year. You could tell early in the year, Ryan Day was kind of showcasing what Justin Fields could do as a quarterback. And it was extremely efficient throughout the beginning of the year. He was having games with more touchdown passes and incompletions and all of that. But as the season is drawn on, and teams are a little bit more prepared to double Ohio State's best receivers, they have had to rely a little bit more on the run game. So that's where I think it starts. And then, from a scheme perspective, things like formation and a boundary. So putting all of your receivers to the short side of the field, putting your tight ends, your backs to the field, that clearly gave Clemson issues. And a lot of teams do that for specific reasons. Some teams do that to throw to a single receiver out to the field because you get one-on-one coverage. But in the case of Ohio State, they did that to throw deep. And that was something that I think that Clemson was not prepared for.
So formation into the boundaries, just for listeners at home who might not know, and obviously podcasts is a visual medium, formation into the boundary is basically more players into the short side of the field, more skill guys, right? So you have five receiving options. That means loading at least three guys into the short side of the field. This is a bigger deal in college than the pros, because the hash marks in college are wider. So you actually have, your field side is legitimately much, much wider than the boundary side of the formation is. That's why sometimes you'll see these corners who play field corner in college, their numbers look amazing. And part of it is just because most of these college quarterbacks don't have the ability to really threaten and throw the ball over their head, accurately to the wide side of the field. Are you surprised that Clemson was not able to adapt to this?
Partially, but I think really it was just the fact that they were at a talent deficit at DB. Some of the answers that they had, I think, was fine. A lot of teams play cover three like they did when they get formation in the boundary, or play softer zones. They just had an issue of Chris Olave running past the deepest player, you know, or Garrett Wilson finding a seam against the deepest player that they had in zone coverage. So there's not an answer for that. If a guy is faster than the guy you have deepest, there really is no answer for that. I was surprised to see that it went on for as long as it did. It's one thing to, you know, maybe you hit a shot in the second or third quarter, and that's kind of your big game-breaking play. But it was drive after drive after drive, deep shot, deep shot, deep shot, you know, just marching down the field. That was the part that really shocked me.
Well, one thing that interested me, and going into the game, we speculated about this. Said, okay, what might Ohio State break out that Clemson hadn't seen? And they really had not run Justin Fields all that much. But, you know, for those of us who saw Justin as a recruit, I mean, I thought his game stylistically and physically, the comparison's not there, but I always thought it you know, when you watch the movie Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, mm-hmm. and they hit him with the ray that shrinks him back, or, you know, grows him back up. It was almost like a jumbo Russell Wilson, right? Like the way he moved around, and there's obviously the baseball comparison there too. They were running the heck out of Fields early in that game, and until, you know, he got hurt. He was on pace for like 150 rushing yards. That, yeah. To me, it's impressive that Ohio State had that other stuff they could go to, when I think clearly one of their early inclinations was to run Fields a pretty good bit. And then he gets hurt, and they still are able to bomb it, you know, all over Clemson, and you know, able to use that formation in the boundary to get deep. Spinning this forward to Alabama, mm-hmm. right? How much of the effectiveness of this for Ohio State, and maybe it was one touchdown worth, two touchdowns worth, how much of that would you attribute to the element of surprise, in that it's not something that Ohio State had shown a lot? And how much of a disadvantage do you think it is for Ohio State that Alabama has now seen this specifically from the Buckeyes?
To me, I think that, to answer the first half of your question, the formation and the boundary stuff, I think, was the difference in the game for them offensively. So that, and to me, that won't happen again. A, because your opponent has already seen it, and B, because your opponent is Nick Saban in Alabama. And he's the kind of guy that will have an answer for that. I still expect to see a good bit of it. I don't think that was a one-time thing, because it was a very effective way for Ohio State to manufacture space, you know, getting their fast guys from the short side of the field and running posts back to the wide side. That's a really good way to kind of counteract the way the teams like to double receivers or keep some kind of like guy over the top, you know. So I expect to see it again. I just don't know if it'll be as effective. You may not see the 56, 67 yard touchdown passes, but they can still find some offense with it.
Which is interesting, because, you know, just looking at Bill Connolly's stats, my former podcast partner and now at ESPN, you know, Bill shows that one of the, I don't know if you call it a weakness, but certainly one of the non-strengths of this Alabama defense, they're 90th in passing marginal explosiveness allowed. So when Bama gets hit, it usually is a big pass play. In watching Alabama this year, when they've given up the big pass play, is it something that is similar to what Ohio State did to Clemson?
Yes and no. I would say yes in the sense that, because they do play a lot of one-on-one coverage on the outside, that is what you're inviting. And that's just kind of the MO of Saban, is if you're going to beat me, you're going to beat me with your best guy on my best guy out on the perimeter, you know, and that's what they'll live with. So you will see that. We'll definitely see some opportunities for that. It's going to be up to Ohio State's receivers to beat Jobe and Surtain and their defensive backfield. So that's really kind of where the matchup will be decided. I watched some of the Florida game, you know, even though Florida, for as close as the score looked, I would not say that they were ever really in it. But when they were rolling offensively in the second and third quarters, you saw guys like Kyle Pitts up the seam. Early in the game, they were able to hit Kadarius Toney out on the sideline. So the opportunities will be there. I think my concern is, because I'm still not very sure where their tight ends are at as receiving threats, that's kind of where my concern is, as far as like, if they're not able to separate from Alabama's linebackers and they don't have to commit safeties to cover those guys the way that Alabama did against Florida and Kyle Pitts, then maybe the space won't be there. But again, Saban lives and dies with his corners and one-on-one coverage. So I would not be surprised if we saw at least 5 or 7 snaps where that's kind of where the game is decided, is whether or not they're able to get those big chunk plays out on the perimeter.
The tight end point you bring up is really interesting to me as well. I haven't watched every single snap of Ohio State this year, but I don't recall them throwing the ball to the tight ends quite as much as they did against Clemson, and you know, using some of that play action out of 12 personnel. That to me also seems like something that maybe just the frequency with which they were going to the tight end in the passing game against Clemson maybe caught the Tigers a little bit off guard. And I'm wondering, similar to the receiver question, how much do you think they can replicate that against Alabama? Because again, say you're DC, Saban just saw it.
Yeah. It's hard to say that it'll be to the effect of 49 points. You know, I just don't know if that's where it's at. I've never been a big fan of Dylan Moses as a cover guy. I think he's a good athlete, but not a plus coverage guy. So if they can find a way to isolate a matchup with a Rucker, you know, against Moses, maybe you can find that kind of size mismatch. And Notre Dame did have a few opportunities in the pass game to get the ball to their tight ends. What I think the issue was is they couldn't hold up in protection. So, and that's where you kind of get into the trade-offs. One thing that Ohio State likes to do with their downfield passing is max protect. So they're going to leave their tight end and running backs in, you know, and have seven in protection and three guys out in the route. That's something that can work if you're looking for downfield shots. But again, you're subtracting a receiving threat. So, you know, they do have to make those decisions on trade-offs. And if they can hold up in protection with five linemen, then maybe we'll see more opportunities for a Rucker to, you know, get downfield against Dylan Moses and the rest of the linebacking core.
That pass protection battle for Ohio State is going to be fascinating. I did not expect Bama's defensive line to win that often against Notre Dame. I thought Notre Dame's offensive line was pretty good. Now, losing their top two centers, I think, contributed to some of the protection issues. They had a couple free runners allowed, but they also just had some, you know, like there were some busts, but they also just had guys just get whipped.
Yeah.
And that's not a great sign if you're playing this Alabama team right now, if their defensive line is just going to, you know, round into form. Right? They have some guys who were former, you know, 5- and 4-star freaks. Will Anderson, we loved his recruit. We had him as a 5-star after the All-American Bowl, where just nobody could block him. Tim Smith, who's 330-something pounds, was actually playing left field as a sophomore.
Wow.
Down in South Florida. Like, he's eventually grew out of it, but I was talking to his coach down there in the 2018 Nike opening camp down there, or back when it was still the Nike opening. And he's like, yeah, he also plays left field. That dude plays left field. Like that.
Right.
That just shows you the kind of a kind of ability that they're working with there at Alabama. And obviously Ohio State recruits at about that level. What run game wise, and I think we have to just record this whole show with the assumption that Ohio State's going to be healthy. There's no real use for us to get into speculation of who will and won't play. And let's assume that Fields is healthy, but I think we can reasonably assume maybe he's not 100% healthy because the shot he took.
Yeah.
Can they effectively keep Alabama off balance with the run game if Fields is not a big part of it?
Tough. Almost any game that we see where Alabama's opponents are effective running the ball, the quarterback has been a big piece of it. You know, reequating those numbers. So making a defense play 11-on-11, in the run game, that's usually your best bet. You know, a lot of teams, it's one thing to scheme up where you'll have space and gaps, but the issue with playing against Alabama is your run scheme is only as good as winning your one-on-one blocking matchups, and you don't do that very often against them. You know, I think that there's been some attrition with them up front and with their linebacking core from what peak Alabama defense has been, but it's still dudes. You know, you're still dealing with some freaks up front, so. Without Fields as a runner, it's tough. Trey Sermon would have to have not necessarily a Northwestern game in terms of production, but effect on the game. He would have to be able to carry that entire running load on his back, you know, especially with Teague kind of being in and out of the lineup. So it's going to be difficult, I think. Not as easy as it's been the last couple of weeks.
That'll certainly be a matchup to watch here. One last thing with this Ohio State offense against Alabama's defense. Nick Saban's defense is actually – he's had some issues with formation into the boundary with some of his coverage checks. And as a defensive guy, I'm sure you can explain, you know, the type of coverage checks you have to make when you get formation into the boundary, especially if you're calling your defense to the strength, right?
Yes.
Specifically here, a guy who's been a thorn in his side who happened to get fired this year, Gus Malzahn, routinely was able to get guys running free in his secondary. Hugh Freeze did it at times back when he was at Ole Miss, and even going down the the Nick Saban coaching tree, famously in that national title game where Jeremy Pruitt was coordinating Florida State's defense, Auburn hits like a 70-yarder, and then they additionally, I think they get Ricardo Lewis free again, totally uncovered because Florida State blows a check to trips to the boundary. When Pruitt obviously off the Saban tree, that was 2013. How has Nick changed the way his defense is called in response to some teams maybe finding the kind of exhaust port on the Death Star, right? Like, hey, maybe if they mess this coverage check up enough, we can get some shots.
So I'm glad you brought this up. In the coaching community, there was a clinic that Kirby Smart gave where he kind of detailed this whole thing. Like, this was not just an issue. So that way listeners can kind of understand that this was like an identity crisis level of problem where they had to change a lot of what they did defensively because, like Clemson does now, they used to call their defense to the field. They would consider the field the strength. Which makes sense, right? Generally speaking, offenses align to where they have the most space. That's what makes sense, especially with college or high school hash marks. Now what they'll do is they set their nickel. So that third corner, third safety type, they set him to the receiver strength. So if they go trips in the boundary, I think Saban now feels like he still has answers because he's got a numbers advantage to where you put the most receivers. So that way you're not going to see things where they have maybe their third best cover guy just out covering space to the field and a linebacker having to walk out and go cover a Garrett Wilson in the slot. You know, those are the types of things that you would see earlier, you know, from 2013 to 2016, when it really looked like maybe that Saban tree of defense was slipping a bit. That was kind of what was behind it. But teams like West Virginia, Auburn, you've mentioned, Ohio State in the playoff game, hit them with this a couple of times. Things like tempo and formation in the boundary have been a thorn in the side for the Saban tree of defensive coaches for a while. I do think now you'll probably see a little bit more of an evened out type of game plan. So you'll see their best guys covering Ohio State's best guys a little bit more often.
What year was that clinic, if people want to look for? Is that 2015?
That was, or 14? So this clinic was while Kirby was at Georgia. So this may have been 2018. It's a Nike Coach of the Year clinic. I can find the link because I have it, and I will post it for people who want to watch it, and I'll make sure that I get it to Bud as well so you guys can all see that.
We'll try and throw that in the show notes as well. I remember Tom Herman coming there and actually, you know, discussing with Nick Saban how they had attacked that defense after that 2014 title game.
Mm-hmm.
This has been fun. I think Ohio State's got a legit shot to score points here, just, you know, based on our conversation and the personnel that we know they have. When we come back from the break, we will talk about the other side. Does Ohio State have a shot to stop this Alabama offense?
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
All right, so we're back now on the Barton and Bud podcast. Our guest, Deontay Lee, you can follow him on Twitter at DLee_TPC. He's on the Post Corner. He's on Cleveland.com, defensive coordinator of Mara Vista High School there in SoCal. Awesome film breakdowns. I think it's a really worthwhile follow to hit up Deontay. So we just got done talking about Ohio State's offense against Alabama's defense. Some of the stuff Ohio State does is stuff that, you know, has been a Bama weakness in the past, but you know, Saban has tried to adjust for it. Now, on the other side, this is a bit of a different animal here. This Bama offense is, it's kind of automatic. They have ridiculous talent all over the field. We know about Devontae Smith. John Mechie has been a pleasant surprise. Not in that we didn't know his talent. We had him rated highly, but that he's emerged this quickly, I think, has been a pleasant surprise for Alabama. Their offensive line is just ridiculous. And then they also, they add in some other elements that I've noticed this year that are different. They're not just the typical college offense. They're very motion heavy. And they have all these other elements you have to account for as a defense. They're not just, hey, we have good players and we're going to RPO all the time, right? They'll get in heavy sets and they'll go hard play action. They certainly do the RPO stuff. And I take this wherever you want to take it. But when I watch these guys, and I like watching the lines, it does seem like their offensive line for the Tide just provides them the ability to do so much, so many other things that other teams just can't do because they can protect it.
Yes, absolutely. But to your point about what they do on offense, it does get a little monotonous. You know, if you watch one team, it's why the Y is on the tight ends off the ball. They got three receivers split out. It's split zone. It's RPOs, you know, and that's basically all you see. But when you watch a team like in Alabama, it's shocking to see how much offense they run. So the motions, as you mentioned, the hard play action, they'll run old school outside zone. You know, I've seen them run buck sweep, you know, which is like an old school wing T play with Najee Harris. They will take their deep downfield shots. Any offense you can think of that you've liked in the last 10 to 15 years, they have some kind of element of it. I've seen them run mesh better than air raid teams. So, you know, they've got a little bit of everything. And I do think that it starts with what they are or what they have up front. If they want to just protect with five and play like LSU did last year and go empty, they can do so. They've got the talent on the outside and they can protect Mac Jones long enough to do so. If they want to bring in two tight ends or a tight end and a fullback and mash you in the face with power and inside zone and dive and all those things, they can do that as well. And, you know, especially when they had Waddle available, and we'll see kind of what his status is going into the title game. But when they want to, they can go 4 or 3 wide and go through all your kind of pro style progressions if they need to as well. So they've got a little bit of everything.
It really is ridiculous. I've always kind of liked Mac Jones. I saw him a lot in the 7-on-7 circuit in the state of Florida, and 7-on-7 is not, you know, is not real football, but it's not nothing. The one thing I like about Jones in this offense is I don't know that he's the best at evading pressure, but he is very comfortable operating with bodies around him. And there's a difference to me. Like, you know, evading a free runner because you got a bust is one thing. And I don't think he's great at that at all.
Right.
But he does not seem to be rattled when there's pocket compression around him. And I think that's a huge deal because a lot of quarterbacks do not like operating with bodies around them. Jones seems to have justified confidence, I would say, that all right, these guys are getting close to me, but they're not actually going to touch me. And he keeps his eyes downfield really well, I think. You're not able to get him off his spot very much, and he's not a guy that has to. I don't think he has to reset all that much. He's just comfortable kind of standing there, understanding that the line is going to allow him to get the ball off. I know you reposted something earlier, or did you post it and then Tyson?
I was talking to Nate Tice about it, and then he drew it up and posted it and tagged me in it. And then I dropped a video for it, so people had a visual reference for it.
It's just the ability for Alabama to just explain this play if you can for the podcast, but it just struck me as absurd that they could protect this with a 5-man protection. So everybody's out in a route. It's just the offensive line protecting. And it's a play that most college teams against good defenses just can't do this.
Yes. So it's been explained to me as a climb concept, but basically what it is what Alabama does with it. They flare out the back. So the back is just sprinting out on like a swing pattern. He's the check down. You got two fade routes on the outside. One of the slot receivers is running like an over route, a crossing route. So think like 15 to 18 yards deep, right in front of the middle of field safety. And then Devontae Smith, who is in the other slot, he runs what looks like a drag. And then he just climbs up the field, almost going to like the opposite pylon. this is a play that takes 4.5 to 5.5 seconds before the ball's even in the air. And they were able to protect it. Like, when I say protected, I don't just mean he let it go as he was getting a helmet in his chest. He was comfortable enough to step up in the pocket, wait, it was clean, and then he got to throw a great ball to a wide open receiver. And teams just can't do that. The list of teams who do, it's like Oklahoma, and we know that they have a great reputation for being able to protect with five guys. They always develop and recruit well up front. LSU had the offensive line to do stuff like this. They didn't do it a bunch, but they had the line to do it last year. A team like an Ohio State maybe can do it, but you're looking at very thin, you know, a very thin list of teams who can pull something like that off. And when you can do stuff like that, the possibilities are endless for you as an offense.
And you've been in these coaching meetings. Like, if the offensive coordinator suggests running this, more than likely the head coach is going to be like, no, we can't protect that. Like, no, get this out of here. You know, and the offensive line coach is like, what?
Yeah, it's a great way to get an expo marker thrown at you by the offensive line coach.
So Ohio State, great offensive game against Clemson, but they did still allow 400-something yards passing to Trevor Lawrence. In watching, we'll get to what Ohio State did well defensively, but I think to keep this conversation about Bama's offense for now, what did Clemson do offensively that you think Alabama can replicate?
So
the thing, or will want to replicate, I guess.
I mean, number one, and I hate having to harp on this so much because it makes me sound like I don't like the player, and I do, but it's attacking Sean Wade. That was, anytime they needed a completion, Clemson, in that game, it was Norman Powell on Sean Wade. And it was any route you can think of, whether it was a fade, a corner route, a curl route, you know, a 10-yard in, anything that you can think of, that's where they attacked. So that's kind of what I'd be looking for Alabama. They obviously have the horses on the outside to do so. Wade, for what he does provide to a defense as a cover guy, one-on-one coverage out on the island is not really his thing. And that would be the thing I would be looking for Alabama to attack early and often.
All right, so let me ask you this then. Ohio State kept leaving him out there, right? At some point, this is a conscious decision by the Ohio State defense to do that. So let me ask, you're DC. Let me ask you, why did they elect to keep leaving Sean Wade out there on that island in which he was repeatedly getting kind of embarrassed on that island? Is it because, I mean, this is your opinion. We haven't talked to the Ohio State staff, I assume. If you have, then this podcast is like double off. But is it because they're trying to protect their other guys in the secondary? Like, are there other guys that secondary they feel worse about? So they're like, all right, just pick your poison.
So I was talking with Seth Galina about this on PFF's podcast, and I think he mentioned the fact that Ohio State played maybe 11 snaps of nickel that weren't like obvious third and long passing situations or end of game kind of 2-minute scenarios. And really what I think it is they've just made a decision that their best 11 guys is just their base personnel guys. So they have 3 true linebackers, 2 true safeties, and their 2 corners. And I think they've just decided that the best way to protect their linebackers who are not cover guys is to just play single high, cover 3, cover 1 defense. And I guess they've just kind of made that decision that they're going to live with their corners being by themselves, even if it costs them a few big plays.
So we really don't expect them to do that much different here.
I'd be shocked. I would be shocked if Kerry Coombs had anything different than what they've been doing all year.
Because I don't think Seven Banks is a bad player. You know, no. It just, whoever draws the Devontae matchup, that's going to be difficult. I mean, we talk about these guys coming back for their senior seasons, and I mean, Smith is legitimately like having an NFL player on your college football team, and a good one. You know, just the way he runs routes and the toughness and the ability to catch the ball. And I like that he and Judy had this similar thing. Judy might have been a little bit better at this, but I think the thing, just being a guy in South Florida, that I always saw with Jerry was every route looked the same.
Yes.
Always. And it just makes it like you didn't have any tells. I didn't think it was very, Marvin Harrison-ish.
Yes.
Right. In Judy's game, which I know we're not supposed to say that name, but, so knowing like, so if Bama assumes that they're going to get singles on Sean Wade, is Ohio State, like, are they in trouble here?
So the way I've been framing this is, and I'll ask you this question, What's the magic number for Alabama point-wise where Ohio State can feel like they can stay in the game?
So I was going off on Dabo Swinney a little bit on Twitter about this, and when he was making all his decisions to punt the ball. And my thing is look, I don't think you need to play insanely aggressive or, you know, optimal strategy, blackjack or whatever, always go for it. But I do think you need to be generally aware of what the numbers say is going to be required to win the game. Mm-hmm. And in that game, their over-under was like 78, I think.
Yeah.
And they were favored by a touchdown. So just off the bat there, Vegas is implying something of like, you know, 43-37.
Right.
You probably need to have 40 points to beat Ohio State in this game. And then as a coach, you should be adjusting in-game based on what is happening in the game. So like you should just at least look at the over-under and split it in half and say, okay,
right,
how many points do we need here? Probably 40. Well, the over-under in this game is 75. And Bama's favored by 8. So I think if Bama goes into the game and says, hey, we need 40, I don't see a way. I shouldn't say that. I think they have to feel pretty damn confident they can get 40.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Most likely, right?
Yep. When I talk to people, I've said that Ohio State needs to feel like we've got to put 45 on the board just to have, you know, a puncher's chance. It's got to be that. When I asked Seth, he said something like 30. When you watch Alabama, every time they touch the ball, they score. I can't think of a pathway for Ohio State to hold them to 30 if it's not like, you know, Mac Jones has his worst game, sack strips and pick sixes. You know, that's the only way I can see it. If they can sustain drives, they score.
So, Art, this is actually a great segue then. What is Ohio State's path, not to stopping Alabama, but to holding them to, let's say, you know, 38, 42, something that's not a 45? Like, what is Ohio State, like, can their defensive line win against Alabama like they did against Clemson? Because I thought their D-line might have had one of its best games of the year against Clemson.
I mean, they whooped them. It was bad, especially by the second half. It was bad up front between Ohio State and Clemson. And if you're Kerry Coombs, that's kind of what you got to bank on, is something similar. Maybe not exactly that, but something similar. So for them, I'm sure they're saying, we know we probably can't cover these guys. So the idea is, let's just stop the run. We're going to sell out on stopping the run, hold Najee Harris to, you know, maybe 2-3 yards per carry. And at least then you create obvious passing situations and you can kind of, and then you can get into doing what they were doing against Clemson, which was just jumping the snap, timing the cadence, and just tearing off up the field. And that was how they were able to get pressure on Trevor Lawrence late in the game. But if the idea is we can just line up man for man across the board and cover these guys, it's going to be a long one.
How are they able to jump the snap so well against Clemson? Did Clemson have a tell, or were they just falling into the trap of using a very similar count each time? Because they really were getting off the ball extremely well.
Clemson stopped mixing up the cadence, and this is where I put my coaching hat on and start complaining. But the clap cadence thing bothers me in those situations because it is an easy tell. Even for guys who try to simulate the fake clap to see if they can find the rotation of the defense, if you're not using vocal cadence, it does get easy. And quarterbacks have tells, and in situations where you know the pass is coming or you know they have to get as many plays off as possible in a short amount of time, you can really tear off. Guys aren't going on to, you're not going to get the check with me, or, you know, dead count type of stuff. And that was obvious. You know, they were tearing off up the field against Clemson, especially late in the fourth quarter.
That's a little bit surprising, you know, just given how veteran of a quarterback, you know, Trevor Lawrence is, and yeah, he doesn't make a ton of mistakes.
Right.
Additionally, something, you know, you said you put on your coaching hat there. Clemson did not have Tony Elliott for that game. Now, the first couple drives, they were finding the duck for sure. Mm-hmm. Ohio State's defense. And,
yes.
You know, like over and over again. And at that point, actually, it wasn't Wade, right? It was not Borland, but the
Warner.
That repeatedly, and I feel like that's probably why one of the reasons why Ohio State said, okay, like, you can pick on Wade. We can't allow this you know, to continue to happen. But if you look at Clemson's efficiency after those first three drives, I mean, it went down a ton. I think Ohio State allowed like 150% more yards per play in the first, you know, couple drives, which I'm going to interpret as them being on script, at that point, or at least mostly on script. I mean, it's 16 plays. I think that's fairly scripty, you know, for most teams. I do wonder how that game looks. I think Ohio State still wins. If Tony Elliott's there, though, I don't know that it is quite the blowout. And so I'm interested to see what some of Alabama's answers will be for this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it was clear. For as much as I think everybody's trying to avoid making it sound like we're excusing Clemson's loss, we can't understate the fact that not having your offensive coordinator that you've had for multiple years now call plays, you know, in a big game like that. And as you mentioned, I mean, once they were done with their opener, so that 15, you know, those first 15 plays that you have that you're going to run basically no matter what, you know, obviously they carved up Ohio State's defense with that. And that was part of the stuff that I had previewed going into that game, was all of their kind of cover three single high beaters. And they basically emptied their clip. They shot all their guns in that first quarter. And I think if you have an offensive coach who has a better feel for the game than a guy who you're asking to go from quarterback's coach to being the guy calling the plays for you, you probably don't get that stretch of Ohio State touchdown, Clemson punt, Ohio State touchdown, Clemson punt, Ohio State touchdown, turnover on downs. And all of a sudden you look up and you're chasing three scores. So those are the types of things that I think in terms of game control that we're probably not going to see when they're playing off against, when they're facing off against Alabama.
Another interesting thing here that I want to see in this game, you mentioned Clemson, or excuse me, Ohio State will probably play, you know, a lot of single high, a lot of cover three type stuff. I don't think they're going to man up Alabama very much. I think you're getting mostly, you know, cover three looks here, and they'll try to match. But I thought Notre Dame strategy wise was pretty much optimal for their personnel against Alabama. You may disagree. If you do, I mean, please let me know. I thought, given what they have, they played pretty optimally. They just didn't always execute it very well. Like, their strategy to me was keep everything in front of them. And then maybe Alabama gets greedy or impatient and they'll throw you a pick. And if they don't, then try to basically play red zone roulette, as I like to call it, you know, just, hey, stuff happens in the red zone, right? It does. And being a great offense in the open field is not always the same thing as being a great offense in the red zone. The tight area is different. The issue with Notre Dame is they didn't tackle anybody.
On those short
throws. I mean, they just got absolutely cooked on the underneath stuff. Do you think Ohio State will try to play a little bit tighter cover three look, or do you think they're going to try to copy the Notre Dame game plan, tackle a little better, and then hope that they have some red zone luck?
I'd say probably the latter. The tighter you get to their receivers, the more you're inviting, you know, those bombs over your head. So I would expect that they play a pretty soft cover three, just like Notre Dame did. And as you said, I mean, they kept the game in front of them. All of the explosive plays that Alabama had was Najee Harris jumping over a guy. What do you do about that? Nothing, you know? It's Devontae Smith on, you know, that little glance RPO, and then he just runs away from your guy because he's a better athlete than, you know, your nickel corner. That happens. And then it's, you know, a bubble screen where he just outruns the leverage of the defense again. So, but, you know, I think that as a defense, if that's the kind of scheme you have, that's what you live with. So I wouldn't be surprised if they say, hey, we'll line it up, we'll keep you in front of us, and if your athletes are better than our dudes, there's not an answer for that either way anyway. So, you know, we'll kind of live with it that way. So that's kind of where I'm thinking that we'll see it, which is interesting to me in terms of like a possession game. So can they limit Alabama's possessions? Because like I said, when they touch the ball, they score. So if Mac Jones gets, you know, 6-7 possessions in the first half, you are in danger of giving up 35 points by halftime. It's something that can happen, you know, and playing red zone roulette probably is their best way for it.
Oh, if Bama gets 15 possessions, I think this is over. Like, yeah. I have a really hard time thinking that Ohio State can hang with them for that many possessions as far as, you know, matching score for score. But the pace thing is curious here. What do you want to do with pace? Ohio State is almost never the team that is less talented. Like, this is very uncharted territory for them. And yet, if you want to follow Notre Dame game plan, the Irish, you know, once they got off their script, which they were actually kind of playing some tempo for the opening script, which threw me off for a minute, because I was waiting to hit a live under bet in the game. And like, as soon as they stopped snapping the ball with 23 on the clock, I'm going to fire these unders, but they took them like three series. Like, this is, guys, what are you doing? Like, what are we doing? And then I got like 73.5 and it was golden, you know, for the undershot. But do you think Ohio State tries to limit limit possessions and play a slower game here?
It sounds to me, it always sounds counterintuitive when you're playing a team as talented as Alabama. But when I think about the teams that have beaten them, almost all of them were tempo teams.
Yeah.
And that's where you kind of have to make your choice. You know, the Deshaun Watson Clemson team that won was not more talented than that Alabama team, in my opinion. I just think they had an advantage at quarterback. And the way that they were able to exercise that advantage was trying to get 99 plays off in a 60-minute game. And just wearing down the defense. And you can, if you watch the flow of the game and not the highlights, you see Alabama's killing them up front in the first half. Right before halftime, it looks like things are starting to go in a different direction. And then by late in the third to the early fourth quarter, you could tell they were gassed. So I'm interested to see if Ryan Day says to Kerry Coombs, hey, we don't care. We're going to run as many plays as we can and try to get in the end zone as often as we can. It is a tricky situation to ask your team with a shortened amount of possessions to beat a team that's more talented than you. I think about this kind of ties into basketball, which is another sport I'm interested in. The more talented teams usually play faster. So you ask the less talented teams to play slower. And then you kind of get into that, you know, trade-off of, well, every turnover we have in a low possession game costs us twice as much, right? Because we have less bites at the apple. So for me, I would say you've got a guy like Justin Fields. Maybe you just want to let it hang. You know, if we lose, we lose. They're more talented anyways. I want to make sure that my best player has as many bites at the apple at it as he can get, you know, and if we end up losing the way Florida did, where Alabama puts up 50, we put up 40, and we can say it was competitive, even though most people know that we weren't in the game, then, you know, maybe that's as close as we get.
That Florida-Bama game was like an Arena League game. If you've ever bet Arena League, especially live stuff, which I know is probably a very niche audience, it's like you got to remember, okay, you're up points and the ball. Like the mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of like, hey, we're up a score and you know, we have the ball. It's almost like 7-on.
Yes, you know,
in some ways. This has been fun. This is just such a fascinating chess match. I really hope that Ohio State and then obviously Alabama, both you know, are like, I hope these alleged COVID issues are overblown. I'm gonna say alleged, like they're fake. I'm just saying, like, I hope that we don't, you know, that they're not holding guys out of the, or that they don't keep guys out of the game.
Yeah.
You know, hope their tests come back clean. Cause this could be one of the more fun matchups we have in quite a while. Do you got a score prediction?
That's tough. I'm going to say Alabama wins. I will say Alabama wins, and score wise, I'll probably say 48-35. That's about the range that I'm looking at.
I actually had 48 in mind as well for the Tide. I was thinking kind of 48-38, which, I mean, the over, that's 86. You know, I know the over and under 74, but the two offenses that Bama played that are as good as this offense both scored, I mean, about, you know, close to 50 on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I part of that will come down to Justin Fields' health and, you know, who else is healthier on the team testing wise. But I think we probably have shootout making here. It's going to be fun.
Absolutely.
Awesome. All right, guys. Really appreciate y'all following Barton and Bud podcast. Also make sure to follow the Cover 3 podcast, our sister podcast on CBS. Big thanks to Deontay Lee. This was awesome. At @DLee_TPC at the Post Corner. Cleveland.com and Mar Vista High School defensive coordinator. You guys looking good for next year? Or, well, for this year, rather. I'm hoping you guys get to play.
I was going to say, right now, we're still fighting the battle to get on the field. So we'll see. Once we do, whether it's, you know, in the spring or if we have to postpone all this stuff and get back to it in the fall, I'm feeling good about what we've got. But right now, the battle is just trying to come to, you know, some kind of understanding with our state public health authorities and the governor's office as far as timelines with CIF and all that stuff. So a lot of paperwork, bureaucracy stuff. So not pleasant, but we're trying to make it happen for the kids.
Awesome. All right, man. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.